there, and welcome to The Real Stakes, the podcast where we dive into Iowa's agricultural industry, focusing on environmental health and justice. I'm your host, Emma Chervek, and today I'm sitting down virtually with Emma Schmidt, who is the Iowa-based organizer for the Food and Water Watch. And the Food and Water Watch is a nonprofit organization which mobilizes regular people to build political power and to move bold and uncompromised solutions to the most pressing food, water, and climate problems of our time. And if that sounded like a great, perfectly worded mission statement, that's because I read it directly from their website, which you can visit and learn more at www.foodandwaterwatch.org. So definitely go and check them out. They've got a lot of great things going, and it's a great organization. So I'm so excited to talk to Emma today. Thank you for sitting down and talking to me. I am really looking forward to really taking a deeper dive into this industry and sort of getting like a bit of an overview about what is going on, what are the problems, and what can we do about it. So to start off, I was wondering if you could tell me just a little bit about where you grew up in your childhood.
So I grew up in Rockwell City, Iowa, which is where I still live. I've never moved away. It's pretty rural, about 1,400 people, if you don't count the prison population. Then we get up to like 1,800. And it's, you know, really agricultural centered community. It's definitely kind of the perfect example of, you know, most rural communities across the nation where we've seen just massive decline in the past couple decades. I spent most of my youth thinking that I would, you know, move away to bigger and better things, but instead I wound up moving an entire two blocks away from my childhood home.
Can you tell me then a little bit about like your family and how they may have influenced where you're at today with your career?
Yeah. So my mother actually works for the County Department of Health, and my father is a salesman. He sells Snap-on tools. And so he actually goes all over a couple different counties around us, and including to a couple different meatpacking plants. And his opinion of them is a little bit different than mine, but they both always encouraged me to, you know, pursue what I wanted to do, to stand up for what was right. And I wound up working for Food and Water Watch and just doing a lot of other, you know, social justice causes as a result.
Yeah, that's awesome to have, you know, parents who are very supportive and, you know, want you to do what, you know, what you feel like you're supposed to do. That's really cool. So how did you actually become involved with the Food and Water Watch, and what kind of work do you do with that organization?
I actually became involved just with the Bernie Sanders campaign, actually, is when I started paying attention to what was really going on around me. And I started seeing that we had all of these factory farms.
A factory farm can be defined as a farm where large amounts of livestock, like cattle, hogs, or poultry, are raised in conditions meant to increase efficiency and overall profit for the large corporations who actually own the animals. This idea of skyrocketing profits often trumps all other areas of consideration, including individual well-being and living conditions of animals, environmental ramifications, and economic prosperity of the farmers themselves.
Which I'd obviously, growing up in a, you know, county with 200 factory farms, I knew they existed, but I didn't know what was going on in them. I didn't really recognize what they were or anything like that. And once, you know, I kind of opened my eyes, and after Bernie Sanders lost his campaign in 2016, I decided I needed to find something else that I felt passionate about and, you know, that I could pour myself into. And that's how I ended up taking on the factory farm fight and trying to work for a better system of agriculture in Iowa. I've been doing it ever since.
So how would you describe sort of the mission and goals of Food and Water Watch?
Yeah, so our goal is to have people reclaim their political power, to have them hold their elected officials accountable, and also to resist corporate control so we can make sure that we have all the essential resources that we need as, you know, humans to thrive. So that means clean drinking water, healthy food, and a livable climate. We work on a number of issues that are related to that, from banning fracking to ending water privatization. But here in Iowa, our focus is mostly on reforming our food system, specifically by enacting a moratorium on new and expanding factory farms.
Moratorium, by the way, simply means a legal ban, in this case, on new and expanding factory farms.
And we kind of see that as the first step in a broader vision to creating a food and farm system that actually works for everyone, not just these, you know, handful of multi-billion dollar corporations.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds like really important work. So what would you name as some of the successes of Food and Water Watch so far, or what like lasting impacts has the organization contributed to up to this point?
Sure. So on a national level, we were the first national organization to call for a ban on fracking, and we've seen a bunch of wins on that front. We've banned fracking in a couple different states. Same with water privatization. We worked really hard when COVID first kind of started becoming a thing here in the United States to make sure that communities were not shutting off people's water just because they weren't able to pay their bill. Since obviously when there's a massive disease that, you know, could be stopped by washing your hands, it's pretty important to have access to water. And we ended up stopping hundreds of communities from shutting off people's water or water services. Here in Iowa, as far as the factory farm fight goes, one of our biggest wins has just been the fact that we've gotten a bill introduced in the state legislature for the past 3 years calling for a moratorium, which doesn't seem like a crazy like successful thing, but it is, given that most of our state legislators are bought and owned by Big Ag and the Farm Bureau and the likes of that. So that's been really exciting. We've also just seen the movement grow a lot. We've seen more and more people become involved. And I think that to me is the most important part, is that people are actually waking up and paying attention to seeing what's going on and taking action to stop it.
Yeah, yeah, that's really important. Would you say that the Food and Water Watch has faced much opposition? And if so, like in what ways and how has that affected the organization's work?
Always, always. You know, we're going up against these multi-billion dollar companies that are, and we're trying to take them down. And they don't usually like that from us at all. And so, you know, they put out propaganda pieces every now and again. The hardest part for sure is just the fact that they've, you know, organizations like the Farm Bureau, for example, is a big one. They have spread their message for so many decades and have convinced so many people to buy into it that a lot of our work is trying to make people understand that they're lying. They're, you know, Farm Bureau is not out there to help farmers. They're out there as an insurance company and they're profiting off the backs of our farmers, and trying to, you know, get people to realize that this, you know, organization that they thought supports them and has been there for them isn't. It's a tough one. But slowly and surely, we're getting there, making progress.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely sounds like it. And it's also very clear that you're really passionate about this and about the work that you do. What is it that drives your passion or that makes you, you know, so energetic and so driven to continue the work being done at the Food and Water Watch?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of it is just looking around in my own community. Like I said, you know, we're definitely an agriculture community, and the town has been declining since before I was born. We used to be like a pretty poppin' place. People would like to come here. And, you know, we had a drive-in movie theater, a bowling alley, places to shop, things to do, and now we don't even have a grocery store. And a lot of that is because of the structural change in our agriculture system. We went from being this agriculture community that was supported by hundreds of farm families to an agriculture community with more than 200 factory farms that we prop up with our tax dollars. We saw, you know, it, from 1997 to 2017, Iowa lost 85% of hog farmers. And so when the farmers go out of business, they leave communities like mine and they go search for better opportunities. And so pretty soon we don't have the population to sustain, you know, grocery stores or shopping malls. We don't have the tax base to provide, you know, better schools for our children and that sort of thing. And so since I have a 7-year-old daughter and I kind of want her to like living here, I want my community to be able to prosper and thrive. And I don't think it's possible if we continue under this system of agriculture.
Yeah, yeah, no, I definitely agree. And I think the story of your town is one that's repeated all across Iowa, I'm sure, in the Midwest. And so this next question, I know this is kind of a complex topic, but can you give me kind of like an elevator pitch summary of how the corporate agricultural industry works?
Absolutely. I should say before I dive in that a lot of times I use the term big ag to describe the corporate agriculture model. And occasionally we'll get some pushback from using that term from farmers who think that it's, you know, kind of an insult to all farmers. And I just do want to explain that when I say big ag, I mean companies like Tyson or Farm Bureau, Bayer, Monsanto, you know. When people complain about big pharma, they're talking about the insurance companies and, you know, the big players, not the doctors and nurses. So when we say big ag, we're talking about these big players, not your everyday farmer. So when we talk about big ag, though, it's a really complex industry. I think if you go back far enough, most folks associate the decline of the family farmer and many of our rural communities across the nation and just this switch in agricultural processes with Earl Butz. So Earl was actually the Secretary of Agriculture in the 70s under Nixon and Ford. And he helped kind of popularize the get big or get out movement, you know, the whole planning fence row to fence row. You can thank Earl Butz for that. And he really put this trend of, you know, putting greed and of large corporations above our environment and above our communities and our quality of life. And ever since then, it's continued and it's just grown. And we continue to dig ourselves into a deeper hole, especially under Reagan and the 1996 Farm Bill, which most people call the Freedom to Farm Bill. And we've just let these corporations continue to grow in wealth and power while the individual farmer struggles to put bread on his table. And those companies then, that they've continued to exert their power in a number of ways, from buying off our elected officials to spending propaganda in our school systems. And they've managed to consolidate our food and farm system to the point that I think it's over 80% of beef and 65% of hogs are owned by only four corporations, only four, which is just, it's bonkers.
These big four companies are Tyson, JBS, Cargill, and National Beef.
And with that, they've also managed to vertically integrate the industry, meaning that they own almost every single link in the supply chain. So, for example, you have Tyson. Tyson will own the hogs, they'll supply the feed, they'll handle the slaughtering, and they'll get the product to consumers. And so what does that leave the farmer? It leaves the barn, basically. The farmers will just own the barn, and that's it. They don't own the hogs or anything else. And unfortunately, these barns aren't, you know, just some slapped together shacks. They're actually incredibly expensive, high-tech buildings. And, you know, if Tyson decides that your barn is too old or too out of date, well, hopefully you have the money to upgrade your building. Otherwise, they will happily end your contract. And so we see farmers take on all of this debt and all of this risk while corporations like Tyson take all of the profit. And it's a system that just works for Tyson and large corporations, not farmers, not rural communities, and not our environment.
So what would you say are some of the biggest problems within the ag industry in Iowa specifically?
For me personally, definitely the environmental impacts. So Iowa has 10,000 factory farms, if you don't know. And of those 10,000 factory farms, the hog farms alone create 72 billion gallons of manure. 72 billion with a B. And then that manure is overapplied and then it's misapplied to all our acres of corn and soybeans, which are then grown as, you know, cheap animal feed for these factory farm livestock. So it's just this perfect circle. And in many cases, that 72 billion gallons of manure each year will run off into our waterways. So this, of course, in addition to chemical fertilizers, ends up just creating an absolute water nightmare. We can't drink our water. We can't recreate in it. It's dangerous. And we've seen even with the number of factory farms that have, you know, exploded exponentially over the past two decades, we're still using the same amount of chemical fertilizer. So we're just completely overburdening our soil with these nutrients, and they end up seeping out on the land and into our drinking water, causing massive fish kills and destroying areas of recreation so that, you know, Iowans lose out while these massive companies profit. And all this, as a result, has led to over 760 impaired waterways all the way across the state. And we're also the top contributor to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is an area of low oxygen, also called a hypoxic zone, that can lead to the death of fish and other marine life. As of 2019, the Gulf of Mexico's dead zone measured a little less than 7,000 square miles, which is pretty comparable to the size of New Jersey.
We've had over 10,000 private wells across Iowa contaminated with agricultural runoff like E. coli and nitrates and phosphorus. More than 200 community water systems struggle to provide drinking water to their towns. And we've seen the Des Moines Water Works, which has the most expensive nitrate removal system in the entire world, struggle to provide clean drinking water to 500,000 Iowans. And as a result, actually, of that, Food and Water Watch filed a lawsuit along with our partners at Iowa CCI and Public Justice back in March of 2019 against the state of Iowa, saying that they've basically failed in their responsibility to provide clean drinking waters to the people and to provide water for the use and enjoyment of all Iowans. So we actually were protected by the public trust doctrine, which is this very old law that says that the state is responsible for protecting our waterways. And clearly, when you have 760 impaired waterways in the state and 10,000 polluted private wells and on and on, they're not doing that. They're not doing their job. And so we're going to be going in front of the Iowa Supreme Court here shortly to defend our case. And hopefully they'll rule in our favor. And if so, they will enact a moratorium on factory farms within the Raccoon River watershed. And they will also implement a mandatory nutrient reduction strategy. Because right now we have a voluntary nutrient reduction strategy, which is just a series of guidelines for how to keep pollution out of our water, basically coming from our agricultural practices, specifically so that we're not sending it down to the Gulf of Mexico and contributing to the dead zone. But since it is not mandatory, it's not working. There's been a study that has shown that it'll take hundreds to thousands of years before we'll see any improvement from the current practices, because why participate when you don't have to? It's kind of a mess. And that's kind of the water side of things. But we also have air pollution, which we don't talk about quite as much just because it's harder to visualize for certain. But these massive animal operations, they're blowing out hydrogen sulfide, ammonia, particulate matter, which poop, they're blowing out just teeny invisible things of poop, which is kind of gross. And it creates like this massive uptick in respiratory illnesses for workers and for people living nearby, for kids going to school nearby factory farms. And at the same time, while we're, you know, contributing to these illnesses, we're also seeing the massive use of antibiotics create antibiotic resistance. And so if you get sick, your antibiotics no longer work because we have pumped our feed that we're eating and, you know, that's getting into our waterways with so many antibiotics that they no longer work. It's just, it's absolutely bonkers. And I think too, you can't really talk about ag without talking about climate change these days. You know, the livestock industry is responsible for 14% of greenhouse gases. And we've seen that studies have shown that pasture-based livestock emit fewer greenhouse gases. And so I think, you know, if Iowa wants to remain an agricultural state, if we want to remain a state at all, if we don't want, you know, our planet to just blow up practically, you know, it's blatantly obvious that we must reform our agricultural practices. We've been mining our soil for absolutely everything it's worth to create this cheap animal feed for an industry that is, you know, massively contributing to the looming climate crisis. And we're literally digging our own graves. And why? Just so a couple corporations can profit. It's absolutely obscene.
So when I was doing some of my research for this, I came across the Iowa Pork Producers Association, and on their website, they have a page titled 2019 Pork Industry Facts. And one of their subheadings on there was the sustainability side of pork, which I thought was interesting and a little bit ironic, because we don't normally think of the pork industry as being a sustainable industry, right? So I wanted to get your thoughts on some of these claims and if it makes up for the other things that they don't mention. So one of the things they have on there is that livestock production in Iowa supplies about 25% of Iowa's cropland fertilizer needs. And then another one they have says pork sustainability keeps improving. When compared to 1960, the use of natural resources per pound of pork produced has been reduced significantly. Nearly 76% less land is used, 25% less water, and 7% less energy. In all, that shrinks the carbon footprint by nearly 8%. So based on, you know, the work you do and your expertise, what would you say in response to their claims of sustainability here?
Yeah, so the first thing I want to point out is that our public universities, especially Iowa State University, receive massive donations from Big Ag. So I would always be careful of trusting any sort of research because a lot of times it happens at Iowa State University and they do have a tendency to be biased towards, you know, the industry. I'll also say I liked how they commented that we're using, I think, 75% less land. Is that what it was?
76% less land is used is what they say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course it is, because they're putting, you know, 5,000 animals into a tiny barn and making them have a miserable experience where they never see daylight, where they stand on, you know, these bars basically so they can poop and it drops below them instead of, you know, being out in the sunshine and frolicking in the grass like, you know, they naturally would be. Of course they're using less land, but that's for livestock. What they're not accounting for is the fact that that land more than likely has then been turned over to growing corn or soy, which, like we said earlier, is to make this cheap animal feed. And so is it really more sustainable if instead of, you know, having pasture-based livestock, which emits less greenhouse gases and is more sustainable, if you're using it just to, you know, farm fence row to fence row and to over apply all these chemicals to the fields and everything else, I think.
So do you think it is possible to have a truly sustainable agricultural industry? And if so, what would that look like?
Absolutely. I mean, Iowa has always been an agricultural state and it did not used to look like this. I mean, it is entirely possible for our state to continue to be an agricultural powerhouse and do it in a sustainable way that protects our environment, that, you know, protects our farmers and protects our communities. For example, a lot of times we talk about regenerative farming, which is making sure that, you know, you're whatever you take out of the land, you're putting back into it. It's about, you know, really working side by side with nature and letting things be as natural as possible, I guess. And it means, you know, raising cows on grass, not in, you know, feedlots where they're covered in, you know, 6 inches of mud every single day of their lives. We also talk about parity and supply management so that we're making sure that our farmers are receiving a living wage. Talk about grain reserves to ensure that people, we always have a national supply of food. So we have food security and we're not in danger of either running out of food because of natural disasters or that sort of thing. But also it, you know, provides stability to our markets. And that way farmers aren't going through this boom and bust cycle constantly. We also talk about having regional food systems. So we're not transporting food all the way across the country. We're transporting food to, you know, down the block to our neighbor's house. We can raise food locally. We did it before. We can do it again. We can have the infrastructure that we once had that, you know, provided local meat lockers and that sort of thing that, you know, would improve competition within the market, that would provide more jobs because it's not just, you know, one or two companies controlling everything. It's entirely possible to do this. It's just a matter of finding the will and the way of our elected officials to help us lead our way there.
Like, what do you think is the biggest thing that sort of stands in the way of us reaching one of those systems that you were talking about?
It's absolutely the money and the power of Big Ag. These corporations have, like I said, spent decades feeding propaganda into, you know, the public's ear and farmers' ears. My child, actually, last year when she was in kindergarten, came home from school with coupons for a free ham from one of the large meat processors. And they do, like, you know, they do these feel-good activities where they'll give out a pork loin at Christmas or they'll donate football stadium lights to a community. So you think that they're, you know, this heartfelt good company, when in reality they're destroying our rural economies, they're destroying our farmers, and people refuse to acknowledge that a lot of times. And like I said before too, with a lot of our public universities, their funding sways what is taught there, and so we get just a lot of propaganda and it's hard to fight back against. But slowly more and more people are definitely seeing to realize that, it seems. And I think as long as we continue pushing and continue fighting and, you know, speaking truth to power, we'll get there.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So kind of switching focus a little bit, how have you seen COVID-19 affect the industry and perhaps maybe meatpacking plants and communities or rural communities specifically?
Yeah, it's been bad. I mean, I don't think you can exaggerate just how terrible it has been. I think some packing plants have seen up to 60% of their employees infected with COVID. We've seen over 200 packing plant workers die and over 40,000 become ill. It's a really bad deal. And actually, I happen to live in kind of the cross section of multiple packing plants. So I have over in Storm Lake, there's Tyson. To the east of me, I've got Prestige and Eagle Grove, and then there's Denison down south. And so I happen to know a lot of people that work in these packing plants. I've actually got a kind of interesting story. There's also a turkey processing plant in Storm Lake, and they were used to be owned by Hillshire, and not too long ago, a couple years ago, Tyson bought them out. And they haven't, they've been just slowly shifting to like the Tyson model of doing things and integrating with Tyson. So there's still like some of that Hillshire brand practices and whatnot. And Storm Lake also has a Tyson pork processing plant. So when COVID-19 came around, Hillshire, the turkey, they were on top of it. They, I mean, immediately, right away, they were taking temperatures. They were putting up, you know, plastic safety guards, all that social distancing, all that good stuff. Tyson, on the other hand, was not. And you could tell right away because it ended up, I think the Hillshire, which is not still, it is a Tyson plant, but still called Hillshire by a lot of folks. They had like maybe 6 cases, whereas Tyson had triple that amount. I mean, because they didn't care. They were putting their profits before the safety and well-being of their workers. I also heard a funny story. It's not really funny, I guess. But Tyson did eventually start taking the temperatures of their workers before they came through the gates. They would, just as they were driving into the parking lot, they'd take their temperatures. And one day, my friend saw an employee waiting in line to get her temperature taken, and she was rolling a cold can of pop across her forehead in an attempt to take her temperature down because she needed to go to work, even though she was sick, because she needed the money. And I think that kind of just speaks to the Tyson model in general. It's just, it's not something where they care about their workers. They're not, I mean, they're paying decent wages, but they could be better. I also had a friend that lived down in Arkansas, and in Arkansas, there's a lot of chicken processing plants from Tyson. That's where Tyson started. And he came up to Iowa and saw that they were at this point offering like $16 an hour at their pork processing plant. And he says, you know, is there much of a difference between processing pork and processing chicken? And no, there really isn't. And he's like, well, then what the hell? They're only offering us $7.25 down in Arkansas to do it. And it's because they could get away with it. They knew their audience and they had no problem offering to pay their employees as little as they would accept. And it's just, it's a bad deal. Because we've seen just again and again that they care more about money and about, you know, ensuring the durability of their product than they do about their employees and their workers. And it's not good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are really powerful stories for sure. So why do you think that, you know, these issues with, especially considering like workers and, COVID recently, why do you think those issues are so difficult to solve? Or why do you think that the corporations don't care to solve them, even though, you know, people are writing stories about it and, you know, there's media about it that, hey, these horrible things are happening here. Why do you think that is?
Because they don't have to. I mean, if you look at Tyson, their turnover rate is huge. They are constantly hiring because workers are dispensable to them. They always know that, you know, they can hop on a flight to Micronesia and come back with a dozen workers that are ready to, you know, work for a pittance, and they will happily do it, as opposed to, you know, some of an employer that, you know, actually cares about retaining their workers and cares about their well-being. Just they don't care. They don't have to, because they have the money and the power to do whatever they want and get away with it. And nobody really calls them out. Right now, the past couple months is probably the hardest time I've ever seen the media actually taking Tyson down or taking JBS or Smithfield. It hardly ever happens. And so it's been really exciting to hopefully, you know, see people open up their eyes and recognize that, sure, like, you know, in a place like Storm Lake, Tyson has definitely helped keep their community going, and it's kept them growing, and it's, you know, made them one of the most diverse towns in Iowa. But at the same time, they're not doing enough. You know, they could always be doing so much better, and especially by, you know, the farmers and the community itself.
So what kind of solutions or methods of improvement do you see for some of these issues, or like, how would we move forward or combat these things?
Yeah. So one of the top things we have been talking about lately is the Farm System Reform Act, which is a bill that was introduced by Senator Booker and Representative Khanna earlier this year. And it enacts a ban on large factory farms, and it provides the funding to buy out farmers that are wanting to transition to a better system. And it also strengthens the Packers and Stockyards Act.
The Packers and Stockyards Act of 1921 is meant to assure fair competition in trade practices, to safeguard farmers and ranchers, to protect consumers, and to protect members of the livestock, meat, and poultry industries from unfair, deceptive, unjustly discriminatory, and monopolistic practices.
And it helps make sure that there's actually competition within agricultural markets. So it's not, you know, four companies controlling 80% of our beef and 65% of our pigs and 50% of our chicken supplies. So we're really hoping to see that move forward. We've been getting more co-sponsors on it all the time. Of course, we have seen some pushback from it. There's definitely been, at least in Iowa, I know Rita Hart came out and said that she was interested in the legislation, and, you know, she supported family farmers and that sort of thing. And suddenly the Farm Bureau came out and attacked her position on it, saying she was anti-farmer, even though she is a farmer, and she walked back her position. And that's something we see a lot, where, you know, these big ag will, you know, they've been able to tell us what the farmers' politicians should look like. And it's ridiculous, because they're an insurance company. Like, why are we letting them tell us who we should support when they don't even support us? Like, they're actively working against us in our best interests, but we let them do it. And I think we also talked about just other ways to improve what we've got going on, you know, parity and supply management, making sure our farmers are paid a living wage, grain reserves to ensure steady markets and secure food supply.
For sure. I think those
regional
are
regional food systems.
Yeah,
so people
that's a lot
are
of,
shopping local,
a lot of
growing
stuff
local,
that you guys
buying
are,
local,
are
all that
good
stuff.
Food and Water Watch, and that's really
course,
exciting to see.
Pasture-based livestock to lower greenhouse gas emissions and stop mining our land for all of its worth.
So kind of in conclusion, I guess, what can be done by those who are listening today to support the mission of the Food and Water Watch?
The biggest thing is to talk to your legislators, talk to them on the state level, your, you know, state senator and state representative, talk to your board of supervisors, talk to your congresspeople, and let them know how you feel about, you know, what you're seeing and how you believe that we deserve a better system than what we have, how we deserve a system of agriculture that, you know, protects our water, protects our communities, protects our farmers and our climate and everything else, instead of what we've got going on right now, where the only people that are benefiting are these, you know, multi-billion dollar corporations. We also are doing a lot of electoral work right now leading up to the election, in the hopes that we will get some elected officials that can't be bought by big ag. And we will also, in the next legislative session, state legislative session, be introducing a factory farm moratorium bill. And We hope folks will come out and will not come out, technically speaking, since we're assuming there will still be a pandemic and we don't want people coming out, but come out in general, you know, online, virtually, and support the bill and let, you know, their friends and their elected officials know that a better system is possible. And we're ready to fight for it.
Absolutely. One of the best ways we can enact change on an individual level is through who we vote for. I agree. I want to give another big thank you to Emma Schmidt for joining me on my first episode in this series. I had such a blast chatting with her about her organization's work and how it intersects with our industrial ag industry. If you like what you heard, the next episode will probably be right up your alley too. I'll be talking with Timmy Brown Powers, a member of the Iowa House of Representatives who serves in Waterloo, Iowa. She's been very involved in advocating for meatpacking employees in her community during the COVID-19 pandemic, and she has a few really important stories to tell. Thanks for listening and learning with me, and I will see you in the next one.